the tensions between Tonga and Fiji, which would you like?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a breakdown in the Fijian elite. We're seeing a major division with the former leader of the infantry regiment now totally at odds with his former commander. That spells the potential, I think, for greater instability in Fiji. It makes it so important that actually we get Fiji back on the road to restoring democracy and the normal rights of people. And so that doesn't happen by violence and by force. You simply cannot sustain a dictatorship indefinitely and continue to deprive people of their rights.
Well, the time is in their right, do you believe, to go into the territorial waters of Fiji?
Well, I'm not going to get into that dispute. I don't know where they picked them up. I haven't got the details of that. But what makes it clear is that Fiji is now at odds with one of its local Pacific neighbours. This is not something they can blame on New Zealand or Australia. It's putting Fiji at odds with one of their closest friends and closest neighbours. And hopefully that will signal to the regime in Fiji that it is indeed time to change.
What do you think the New Zealand government should do in this situation?
Well, there's not much that the New Zealand government can do. I think we've got to continue to make it clear that we're open for a dialogue with the Fijian government, how important it is to restore democracy and normal human rights in Fiji. And those rights are both democratic rights, but they're also the rights of all people in Fiji to be equal under the law, because it's been a long-standing concern of Fijian Indians that they're not entitled to the same rights as their compatriots in Fiji.
And you would probably understand the Lieutenant General not wanting to return to Fiji to face the rule of law there, given what's happened to other people transferred.
Well, I think what he's worried about is that, in fact, there is no rule of law. If you've got a dictatorship, then you do not have established rights, you do not have an independent judiciary that can guarantee you fair treatment. And the stories that we've heard very clearly are that people in detention have been beaten up, some have been killed. You can understand Colonel Mara's concern about not being subject to that sort of treatment.
Mr. Gough, just on the budget coming up this Thursday, the Prime Minister's indicated cuts to working standards for high-income earners. What do you consider high-income earners in the context of working families?
I think, to the contrary, he's indicated that he's not going to cut the high-income earners. That's what he said in a question to me last week, which begs the question, where is the money going to come from? There is no money at the top end, no significant money. I think for those with a household income over $100,000, it's about $9 million. That's not going to make the savings they want. That suggests that if they're going to do anything meaningful in terms of savings, they're going to be cutting into low and middle income families that rely on working for families to make sure their kids get a fair go. That's the concern that I have. But I suspect that with what he's already done on KiwiSaver, he's not going to want to go very far in election year in cutting back KiwiSaver. I think what we're seeing is pretty much a softening up of the public that this is going to be a black budget. But he knows it's election year. It won't be that black a budget. In fact, the black budget will come if a brash Key government were to be re-elected at the end of the year. Then you'd see some serious cuts.
What other areas do you think we might see cuts in outside of working for families and KiwiSaver?
Well, you'd have to go back to see what he had promised. He promised not to cut GST, and they did it. He promised not to cut KiwiSaver or working for families, and now he's signalling it. So anything that he promised, it looks like he's going to go back on it. So your guess is as good as mine on that. Look, I think the really bad thing is that these promises were made at the height of the global financial crisis. He knew then that you couldn't promise $14 billion worth of tax cuts and at the same time promise, as he did, that he wasn't going to increase GST, that he wasn't going to cut KiwiSaver, all sincere promises made, but made in full light of what the financial conditions were. I think he can't have it both ways. If he's saying, oh, well, we didn't realise how bad it was, he knew full well that was the height of the global financial crisis. And if I can make one other point on that, look, it's very easy to blame the earthquake, but what he is ignoring is that this country will see $10 billion worth of reinsurance funds flow back into New Zealand. That'll give a huge boost to the economy next year. The problem that we've got is not because of the earthquake. It is after the May 2010 budget, we had 6 months where the economy went backwards. No growth, increase in unemployment, increase in inflation. That's where the problem lies. The economy simply hasn't performed.
Why did the economy go backwards, do you think?
Because there was no plan to actually take the economy forwards. We had the gimmicks. You know, cycleways weren't going to create the jobs to deal with unemployment. Putting up GST wasn't going to bring inflation down. Those sort of things didn't address the underlying needs of the real economy, which was skill training, which was the money that needed to go in for a smart economy through R&D, which was new taxation and monetary policies to help the productive sector.
But all of those things wouldn't contribute to economic growth in those 6 months.
But there's no confidence. There was no confidence that the things that needed to be done were being done. And how could there be confidence? I mean, the big answer was to mine in national parks. And that was dropped like a hot potato. And it left a vacuum. And where you've got a vacuum and the economy's going downhill, that undermines confidence.
If it's not a black budget, what colour do you consider?
Oh, I think it's going to be a greyish budget, and the real black budget will come next year if National is re-elected. You see, when they've flogged off all of the assets, what's their next party trick to deal with the fact that they're borrowing money to pay for income tax cuts for the wealthiest New Zealanders? Look, if he really wanted to show that this government was sincere about leadership and sincere about everybody sharing in the sacrifice, the place that he would start with the cutbacks would be the tax cuts to the highest income earning New Zealanders. He'd give up some of the $1,000 a week in tax cuts that he got personally, but there's been no signal that that's what they're intending to do. If they led by example, then people might accept that other cuts had to happen under the circumstances. They're not leading by example. They're putting the burden of the sacrifice on lower and middle income earners.
So you could argue that the tax cuts to higher income earners have allowed them to pay down debt more. Labour's been banging on that the problem is the private sector held by households.
It's enabled the top income earners to do all sorts of things. They can buy holiday homes overseas, they can travel frequently. None of that helps New Zealand. You know, if you want to stimulate the New Zealand economy, just give lower and middle income earners enough money to make ends meet on the basic necessities. Look, if you're at the top end of the market, your flat screen TV has come down in price. If you're a lower or middle income earner, all of the necessities have gone up in price. I was in the supermarket on Sunday. I think we spent something like $338 on groceries. That's for the wife, myself, and my son who's still at home. I mean, the price of everything's gone up. No wonder people are really feeling stretched.
Maybe you like luxury items.
Oh, well, certainly, I'm more able to do that. I was watching other people at the supermarket actually just, really looking at the price of everything, going for the low-cost meat, the sausages and the mince. We bought some chops, half a dozen chops. It was $15 for that. Well, I could tell you, the people that were shopping at this shopping centre weren't going for the higher cuts of meat. It's putting real pressure on family budgets.
Lamb chops. $15 for half a dozen.
Yeah.
What supermarket was it?
It was Countdown and Takanini.
Do you accept...
Do you shop your offer? Yeah.
Do you accept this government has to control the spending of all the GDP's out of control? That's going up.
Look, you can't spend $380 million a week that you don't have. But I don't think that this will be a budget that actually tackles the fundamentals. I think it's a tinkering budget. It'll do things that hurt people, but won't solve the underlying problem.
Just in respect of KiwiSaver, were your comments before, do you believe they're quite moderate, those cuts to KiwiSaver, from what you were saying?
No, they're not moderate for low and middle income people. It's worth $500 a year. If your speculation is right in the media that it's going to halve the government input, well, that $500 a year really does count to people who are low and middle income KiwiSavers. It's not much to people on the high incomes, but it's a lot for those that are really having to scrimp in order to save. The feedback that I was getting over the weekend as I went around my own electorate was really the sense that, well, we can't rely on the government. They keep on going back on their word. They promised they wouldn't touch our entitlements. Bill English said that quite explicitly in the policy document in October 2008. So the feeling out there is a loss of confidence. If we save is the government really going to keep coming to the party, or is this just the first in a series of cuts that will make things harder and harder? We'll be required to put more money in, but they're putting less money in. It's a sense of betrayal, a letdown, that the government hasn't honoured its part of a contract. And people can't get out of KiwiSaver. You know, when they went into it on an understanding that they would make this contribution, and that this contribution would come from the government and this contribution from employers. That's now been changed unilaterally and to their disadvantage. That's why they feel betrayed.
Will you be in a position to restore KiwiSaver from the government's position when you left office in 2008, or is it, are you not in that situation to promise?
Well, you know, what will a Labour-led government be confronted with? A $16 billion deficit this year, a whole series of cuts that have put people in a disadvantaged position. I can't promise to turn that around in a year or even a turn. We're going to have to prioritise.
Will you reverse the KiwiSaver cuts?
I think that KiwiSaver is one of the important areas, but I can't say I'm going to do A, B, C, D and E until I know what the whole picture looks like and we've had a chance to prioritise.
Are you so fundamentally against the cuts around that $1,043 tax credit that would be a priority for you to...
I think what I think you've got to have is a KiwiSaver scheme that encourages more New Zealanders to save, not less. And KiwiSaver was a brilliant success under the Labor government. 1.7 million New Zealanders, 40% of that money, new money into savings. So one of our priorities, if we look at the broad objective, will be to make sure that more and more people continue to save and have the ability to save. Now, how we deal with the specific cuts and how we reverse there and what order we do it in, that's going to take some time to have a look at what the picture is before we can be certain about
it. Well, would you consider making KiwiSaver compulsory and then pay for the, you know, tax incentive by raising taxes elsewhere, and then you've got a tax cut that goes right into savings?
Yeah, well, if you can't find an answer to everything and simply putting up taxes. I've said that people at the top level, they've got to share in the sacrifice. So, you know, John Key's not going to keep his $1,000 a week, I'm sorry. I'm not going to keep the several hundred dollars a week that I got. But we are both in a position where we can pay a bit more. People on low and middle incomes aren't in a position where they can pay a whole lot more in the present circumstances. So we've got to have something where people pay their fair shares and people get a fair go. We haven't got that in the promises that have been made.
What level is rich, Mr. Goff, in New Zealand? What's an income level? A basic income level is rich.
According to John Key...
Well,
let me just finish what I was going to say. According to John Key, if you've got two people, both earning $40,000 to $50,000, which is just under the average wage, that household is rich. I don't accept that. If you look at the top 2 or 3%, obviously they're in the category where they're the richest New Zealanders by definition. They also got the biggest tax cuts. Many of them were our chief executives. They also got 14% increases in their salaries last year, when the average New Zealander got 1.9 and the median income actually went down. So what I'm painting for you is a picture where New Zealanders are becoming less equal, less fair, and the burden is being borne by those least able to bear it, and those that are laughing all the way to the bank. They're getting it both ways. It's not fair.
But when you talk about people who have got, you know, several hundred dollars a week in tax cuts, and talk about the top 2 or 3%, you can't raise a huge amount of tax out of them even by raising their taxes quite a lot.
No, there's a range of things that have to be looked at, and as you know, we're looking at our taxation policy now, and rather than speculate on what we might do in that, we'll finish our process and we'll come back to you on that.
Should you charge $1,000 a week for John Key?
Well, I think if you look at what his overall level of income is, and if he's paying tax on all that income, the people that have done research into that suggest that's what people would get. If you're earning $1 million a year, for example, you're liable to be getting close to $1,000 a week in tax cut.
How many more is that?
Just have to do the maths, don't you? I mean, what his investment income might be, and what he's likely to be getting from that. He hasn't denied explicitly that he's not getting that much in tax cuts or close to it, maybe more than that.
Does a couple on $100,000 combined income deserve state assistance through Working for Families, or do you think that they can survive on their own?
Oh, look, the Working for Families is going to be targeted at people on low to middle incomes.
There's $100,000 combined income.
But there's a reason why, if you've got half a dozen kids, then you're earning between yourself and your partner $100,000, that you still get something back. It's not a hell of a lot.
So you think it warrants that status system?
Only insofar as the abatement rate isn't savage and arbitrary.
Did it go too high, Mr. Gough, do you think, under that second tranche that
no, because
when he had a lot of money put it up and made it more generous?
No, because the level of expenditure at the top level, as I've explained, is relatively small out of something that's, you know, we're spending a couple of billion dollars on. What the purpose was not to make an abatement rate that was so savage that suddenly if you earned a dollar over, then the household income was a dollar over $100,000, you suddenly got nothing. If it was a dollar under, you got a whole lot.
So you don't think they should touch it at all with the families?
Look, my priority is with low to middle income people on working.
But just on that though, do you think
they made the promise that they weren't going to change the threshold. Having made the promise, in the circumstance where they knew about the global economic crisis, I think they should honour the promise, not keep breaking it.
So do you think there is any room to move on Working for Families in any area at all?
Look, Working for Families is money that's targeted overwhelmingly at low to middle income people. If you're going to ask for sacrifice, at least start with the people that are earning the top incomes and got the most back, not on those families that are still struggling to make ends meet. To give their kids a decent start in life. That's what Labor's saying.
When are we going to see Labor's tax policy?
Oh, I think you'll see it well before the election campaign.
Well,
I'm not going to be specific with you because I don't know just yet. We will do the work that needs to be done to make sure that we've got it right.
And
John Worley asked today, as mentioned, the government to bring back your R&D, well, not necessarily Labor's, but bring back an R&D tax credit.
Yeah.
Would Labor commit to that?
What I understand has happened with R&D is that the changes that they made halved the amount of money going into it. And then the decision is now made not by the company, but by bureaucrats in the Ministry of Economic Development. It seems to me that the focus of whatever expenditure you may have has to be about building up our economy so that there is growth, there are more jobs and higher incomes. And that's what I would regard as an investment, not simply a cost. If you're cutting taxes, that's simply giving money out to people. If you're putting money into something like R&D, that's creating more wealth so that everybody can do better.
So Labor's likely to bring it back, isn't it?
My preference would be to have an R&D system that was capable of producing a smart economy, because the answer is not, as Bill English has suggested, simply having a wage rate that's a third lower than Australia. If I want my grandkids to grow up in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane, we'll follow Bill English's advice. If I want to keep them here, that is when I have them, it will be about a smart economy that can offer jobs for them.
Is that a yes, isn't it?
That is it. That R&D, as I've said on many occasions to you, Marie, is a priority.
I know your tax policy is a while away, but do you favour something bigger or bolder, like a capital gains tax as a big revenue raiser, given that the country does face such a massive cash deficit?
I'm not going to speculate on what we're looking at the moment. It just seems to me you've got to wait, see the policy, and when the policy's out, you'll be
able to... Would you rule out us in the green document?
I'm not ruling... Look, there's a whole range of things that we're looking at. I'm not about speculating about it now. I don't think it makes sense to do that.
Haven't you already ruled out a couple of games?
As I say, we're going through our policy. We'll release it in due course, and when we release it, you'll be able to make a judgment.
I'm
not speculating on it.
Is your conference at the weekend a platform where you might release a substantial Labor policy? Or?
No, I don't think we're about to release major policy this weekend. The conference will be focused on organising our campaign. I'll be talking about values and principles and broad directions. But it's not a major platform to release a big policy. That'll come closer to the election, as it always does.
Actually, we're running out of time because of the World Cup. I mean, political debates can get lost for those expenses.
No, I think the idea that the whole of New Zealand stops for the World Cup isn't right. You know, we'll all be watching the big games in the World Cup, but you know, I can fit a couple of games of rugby and rugby league and netball in the weekend without losing focus on all the other things that should be happening in the country. I think you can too. Okay? Thanks a lot. Cheers.